did what, I didn't want to fuck her because I wanted to be with Faith. Fuck Faith.
Did Jamaica believe that?
She knew exactly what was going on. Come on. Come on, Angie. You wouldn't even come to my video. She was married to the nigga and she was fucking me. Come on. You smart.
I just looked at him not saying a word. He kept going.
I don't lie on my dick. It brings me nothing. This right here made me look bad to females to fuck Faith and tell everybody. It made me look bad.
It did.
I would not get more pussy like that. Everybody know that. But I'm not doing it for the bitches. I'm not doing it for the girls. I could care less. I'm destroying a nigga right here. And believe me, every time he touch her, every time he thinks about getting back together with her, every time he thinks of his wedding anniversary, he's thinking of me fucking his wife. And that's as gangster as you can get. Yup. And if you don't understand, don't matter to me. Niggas understand.
Pac was very animated and dramatic about everything. It was overwhelming. I was in no way on his level to be able to challenge him the way I wish I could have. He was a performer. The way he delivered, the way he spoke, he was poetic. He'd be tearing somebody apart and screaming like he was out of control, but he was very much in control. And even at some points, charming and attentive. There were a couple of moments when he'd be yelling and be really aggressive, and then he'd stop and ask,
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm okay."
"You know, none of this is towards you. If I raise my voice, if I'm screaming, it's just how I feel. I want to make sure you're okay and you're comfortable. I just get hyped. Matter of fact, I'm gonna get you a gun. You can sit it by you if you get nervous."
I laughed. "We all right." Is it weird that I thought that was a charming gesture? Probably. But in getting more comfortable, I still knew Pac was talking circles around me. I was trying with everything I had for Tupac to say something that would make the East Coast, West Coast situation simmer down. Ultimately, that's what I was there for. So when he mentioned how crazy the idea of having beef with a whole city was, I encouraged him to speak to that. This is what I was trying to get at. No one in New York has heard you say that.
"Well, why don't you tell them how I flew you out here? This wasn't no publicity stunt. Why don't you tell them how I called you personally and I wanted to get this shit settled and I flew you out here to show you that there was no problem? And tell them how you're not in a hotel room. You're in my home. So what beef?"
"And I have, and I let them know that this was you that wanted to speak to New York. So I'm giving you the opportunity to let people understand what's really happening." The whole time the outlaws were sitting there, I could tell they all looked up to him. Everybody in the room was somewhat as in awe of him as I was. Fatal from the Outlaws was especially nice to me that day, as I recall. He recently passed away in a car accident, and I was really sad to hear that. Every time I'd run into him, even years later, it would always bring us to that moment of sitting in that room. Looking back, I feel that the weight of history wasn't just felt by me, but that something inside Tupac had given him a sense of urgency. It's true that he had been vocal in the media at the time, but he clearly seemed to think it was important to go on the record and cover not just what I'd come for, but other thoughts he had, including his hope to inspire other artists coming up, other voices. At moments, I even felt that Pac was just talking to me directly about why it was important to be authentic and not feel like you had to over-explain yourself. He said he was tired of talking down to people and that if you respected your audience and put them on your level, they'd get it. I couldn't have agreed more, and I carried that with me over the years. After more than 2 hours, I reluctantly began to wrap up the interview. I honestly felt like I could have talked to this guy forever. Pac echoed my feeling right about then, saying, "All right, we just talking shit at this point." And so I stopped the tape. We took a bunch of pictures. Pac sincerely thanked me for coming and told me that if I ever needed anything, to let him know. An hour later, after Mindy dropped me off at the hotel, I still couldn't get California Love out of my head. My mental track was punctuated by 2 hours of Pac saying crazy shit about Puff, crazy shit about Big. I had gotten word from a couple of people that Biggie wasn't so happy that I went to do the interview in the first place. His reaction bothered me to an extent, but not enough to feel like I did the wrong thing. I understood if he felt like that, but there was nothing I could do. I still had to do it. It was the other side of the story. Many times in the future, I would have to wrestle with instances when I chose not to take sides, and with feeling the weight of knowing you have friends and important relationships on both sides. But ultimately, you also have a job to do. There would be so many times when I'd have to talk to people who'd say crazy things about people I cared about. No matter what the situation, I could only do what I believed in. And that was try to give everybody a fair platform. At the hotel, I was getting calls from people at the station. How'd it go? How'd it go? How'd it go? I couldn't even talk to anybody yet. I had to just be in my own zone for a little bit. Again, I desperately wanted to help the situation. People were too invested in this East Coast, West Coast beef. How much further could it go? What, with people getting shot? And I just did not want to go home without Pac's statement that this is not an East Coast, West Coast thing. Which he did say a few times. But then he went on to say other crazy shit. So the big challenge as I tried to get to sleep was how I would help the situation as opposed to inflaming it. What am I supposed to do with all of this? The responsibility was weighing on me. People were literally waiting for me at the station when I showed up the next day after taking a flight from LA early in the morning. No answer had come to me yet about how to edit the interview, and I didn't know who to ask. Why? Because I didn't really trust anybody. Everybody was so opinionated about it and so biased. This had to be one of those times when I decided for myself. Being open to input can be a good thing. But sometimes too many opinions are not a good thing. Sometimes if I start asking people for their opinions, it confuses me. I'm a person who likes to get quiet. And then once I've figured it out, I may pick some people's brains about how to do it. Nobody else is going to have to deal with the repercussions but me. I think I've always been like that. That was the space I was in when I ran into Ed Lover and a couple of the other DJs who were all there at a time when they normally wouldn't be there, all waiting to hear something. It was so intense. I shrugged them all off and went to sit in the editing room by myself and started listening to the interview. I transferred the cassette to a reel-to-reel tape so that I could begin editing. I had a little razor and was cutting the tape and piecing it together with the unused strips falling on the floor. That was the technology of the day. I used to get these little slices on my fingers whenever I needed to hurry up and edit, often causing me to go home with band-aids on my fingertips. The sections that were the most direct were the ones that I focused on.
I really do feel like, fuck it then. What more can I do? I'm not sucking y'all dick. I'm not mad at you. I don't got no beef with you. I'm beefing with the niggas you proclaim to be the king of your set. I'm attacking him. I'm tearing him down. As long as y'all stay on one side of the block, I promise you, I will only destroy this side of the block. All I want to do is get my paper, and all I want to see is niggas out there get their paper. Biggie is a fake player. See, I want to deal with some real niggas. That's all I'm saying. My beef is just with them. Soon as they gone, we're going to try to make New York, man, everything we got you can have. Like we cousins. Y'all want to borrow some sugar? What y'all want? Man, everything. How do you expect me to sit down at the table with niggas that tried to kill me?
Ed Lover came into the editing room and was standing over my shoulder listening. Apparently, he had heard enough that at some point he decided to mention something to Puff about what he had heard. Puff then called Steve Smith and told him, if this airs, it's going to make the situation worse. I'm going to have a real problem with the station. So he got to my program director and got in his head. Now, mind you, I'm sitting in the studio by myself with this little razor blade listening to the interview over and over again, trying to decide what to play. Before I can even figure that out, Steve Smith calls me out of the editing room and says, well, I don't know if we should be playing this. And Puff doesn't think. Puff? What does he have to do with any of this? Well, he just thinks that more people could get hurt, he says. It irritated me that all of a sudden a decision had come from someone who was deeply involved in the situation and didn't work for the station. I don't work for him. It bothered me that everybody was so eager to please Puff before I even had a chance to evaluate the right thing to do. I knew Puff had a lot on the line, but I felt like he was trying to bully the station. Well, you're not telling me I can't play it, right? I just want us to be very careful, Steve said. He paused, as if he were about to put his foot down. Hold that thought, I said, backing out of the room. Before he could tell me something that I didn't want to hear, I got out of there quickly. Like a ninja. I tend to do that before somebody's about to say something I'm not interested in hearing. I see where this is going. I'm not going to let it go there. I'll be back. I'm actually brilliant at extracting myself from conversations I don't want to have. It's a gift. I went back into the editing room and continued as if I were still making the decision about what we were going to do. Ultimately, a lot of what Pac said scared me. My intention truly was to help. But what he gave me was so aggressive and at some points angry. It verged on explosive. Everything main topic was so sensitive, and some of it was so inflammatory that I could see where it could make a bad situation worse. That was never my intent. And now granted, airing it in full would have been the biggest interview in the country. At the time, before all the online content and commentary, pre-social media, radio was the one place where you could experience what it was like to be there in the moment, hearing everything as it was unfolding. It was a really big deal. But the material could have also accelerated this crazy war that I had suddenly found myself on the front lines of. The magnitude of this position and the responsibility hit me hard. So with what I did eventually air, I chose to stick by Pac with cuts that reflected his truth, but that were also positive. I stuck to clips of him defending himself against the rape allegations and talking in general about wanting to inspire people. And yes, I took the best of what he had said about there not being an East Coast, West Coast beef and his clarification that it was about one person dealing with another person. My decision was to use the brief on-air cuts to put some good in the world, to leave his message in, but take out the super inflammatory stuff, even if it was about 85% of the interview. In the end, I played the pieces that really captured the best part of Tupac. I struggled with the fine line between my journalistic duty to keep his meaning intact and not contributing to a dangerous situation as a human being who deeply cared about the culture. Everything had happened so fast. The phone call, the trip to LA, the interview, and the drama over what to air. Even so, all these years later, the details have remained incredibly vivid. I even kept a few mementos. Sadly, over the years, I rarely kept any. That's actually one of the few regrets that I have in looking back. But I did save some from that day. I kept the plane tickets to LA and back, and Pac's box of Newports with four cigarettes left in it. Back then, I smoked cigarettes occasionally, and I was smoking Newports with Pac. So I held on to the box. I just knew that it was such an unusual moment and one that would stay with me forever. I'd come to a turning point. Before that interview, my job was just fun. I finally realized, oh, this does matter. It can matter. It is mattering. Chapter 5, Unbelievable. Bryant Park was buzzing on September 4th, 1996 for the after party following the MTV Music Video Awards that had been held earlier at Radio City Music Hall. As I pushed my way into the thick of it, I couldn't help but feel good that hip-hop was well represented that night. Everybody was there. Snoop and Dre were in town, and so was Pac, as he and Dre had been nominated for Best Rap Video for California Love, although they lost to Coolio for Gangsta's Paradise. The biggest names of the night were the Smashing Pumpkins and Alanis Morissette, each winning multiple awards in the rock and pop categories. As much as I loved Alanis' Jagged Little Pill album, when it came to the show, I was most excited about the hip-hop awards and performances. Nas and the Fugees killed it with a medley of Fuji La, Ready or Not, and If I Ruled the World. Definitely not a bad showing for the culture. Not everybody was happy, though. At the after-party, Suge Knight and Pac complained plenty that Death Row was not given its due, awards-wise or on the show. In fact, Tupac, flanked by the Outlaws and Suge, all carrying signs that read Death Row East, talked to an entertainment reporter about how they were expanding to include East Coast artists. Aside from what was going on with Biggie, Pac called out Nas and apparently now had a beef with him too. Shit was still crazy. Walking into the party, I'd known there was a chance of running into Pac, and I had hoped I would. Snippets from my interview with him had aired over the last several weeks, and I honestly had no clue how he felt about it. All in all, my cuts had gone from a 2-hour interview to about 12 minutes that wound up on air. There had been no word from Pac, so naturally I was somewhat worried he might be angry after he spent so much time and money to make the interview happen. That didn't change my feeling that I had made the right choice not to fan the flames. So there I was, in the middle of the tented festivities at Bryant Park. The Coastal War was still very much a thing, and you could feel high tension in the air, especially because Pac and Nas were both there. There was this moment when I thought, oh God, when these paths cross, this is going to be a problem. And all of a sudden, like in slow motion, everybody realized that Nas and his crew were walking toward Pac and his, all with the same intensity. You could almost hear a gasp from everyone watching, with all of us probably thinking the same thing. Oh God, this could be really bad right now. But Nas and Pac talked. It did feel a little aggressive, not because of them necessarily, but the people around them. That is usually where most of the problems happen, with the crews. But somehow it seemed to be managed. And whatever Pac and Nas said to each other that night, it ended in peace. At some point in the night, I found my way over to Pac. He had a cup in his hand and his shirt was half unbuttoned. He looked like a superstar. He just kind of looked at me and I was like, hi. I'm in some stupid little silver sweatsuit, like a shiny TLC sweatsuit. And Pac was like, hey, you know, I just wanted to come say hello, I said. And I don't know if you heard the interview. I aired it, but I just wanted you to know I had to edit a bunch of stuff out because it felt like it was the right thing to do. But I did my best to not misrepresent you. I understand, Angie. It's all good, he said. We good. And he gave me a big hug. As he did, the tension lifted off of me. I had been so worried, and it turned out he was okay and comfortable about everything. Pac reassured me even more, adding, it's cool, we cool, and I'm still happy you came. We could have talked longer, and I would have had more to say, but there was a crowd around us wanting their moment with Pac, everyone waiting for his attention. So I excused myself. I said, thanks, Pac. I'm glad I went too. He winked at me, and I just kind of crawled away in relief. We were good. That was the last time I ever saw him. It was the last time that most of the people at Bryant Park that night ever saw him. On September 7th, 1996, 3 days after the MTV Awards, we all got the news about what had happened that night in Vegas after the heavyweight championship match between Mike Tyson and Bruce Seldon at the MGM Grand. Initially, the news was just that Tyson had knocked out Seldon in the first round, making it one of the shortest fights in boxing history. But then came word that Tupac, who had been at the match with Suge Knight, had been shot in a drive-by incident as the two of them cruised through town on their way to a club. Apparently, before leaving the MGM Grand, Pac had been in a fight in the lobby that had to be broken up by security. The cause was said to be gang-related. Nobody knew if the shooting had come about in retaliation. But from what was known, a Cadillac had pulled up on the right side of the car Suge was driving, and multiple shots had been fired. The thing about Tupac is that he was always in the news and he had been shot so many times. I thought, as everybody did, oh, he was just shot again. He'll be fine. Nobody thought that he could actually die. But as the next couple of days went by and I heard reports from the news and other firsthand accounts from people I knew who were there to check on him, I started to lose my certainty that Pac was bulletproof. I heard that when they carried him in half conscious, Pac told a medical worker, I'm dying. He had been hospitalized since and was in critical care. He had to be sedated because he kept trying to get up out of the bed. Telling myself he was going to pull through, I still felt a pit in my stomach, like a sense of dread. He was good to me, so kind, and I just liked Pac. In the span of one trip to L.A., we had bonded in a real way. What could I do? How could I say something to cheer him on? There was no texting him or sending an email to an assistant or anything like that. So I wrote him a letter. That's how old school it was. I wrote a handwritten letter, got a stamp, and mailed it to the hospital. Hey, I hope this letter finds you. I hope you are recovering and on your way back to doing what you were born to do. I just want you to know that people are praying for you. We were all waiting to find out how Pac was. By chance, someone who worked at the station knew someone on staff at the hospital and had been giving me confidential updates, confirming what I was hearing, that he was in a coma. That was not good. But I'd remind myself that gunshot victims recovered from being in comas all the time. Then on September 13th, I called our connection at the hospital and asked, as usual, just checking in to see if you have any information on how Pac is doing. There was a pause. Then, in a cautious voice, she relayed the news that Pac had passed. He was 25 years old. Same age as me. My first reaction was shock and disbelief. I put the phone down and sat back in my chair, convinced there had been a mistake. There is no way. There is no way he passed. No way. That's impossible. Why would somebody say that? Now, at this point, nothing had been announced. It wasn't on the news yet. So I picked up the phone again and called the hospital and somehow got through to an administrator who told me that, yes, it was confirmed that Tupac had just passed. Literally just passed. Moments ago. In the middle of feeling so devastated and sad, I knew it was important to share the news with our listeners. I couldn't even begin to think about how. So I turned to Red Alert, who happened to be on air mixing. Red Alert was the original, iconic DJ, who had not only been a pioneer of hip-hop, but I had grown up taping his shows and mixtapes on Kiss FM for years. The only place a kid like me could hear hip-hop on the radio. Right before we went back on the air, I quietly and quickly gave Red Alert the news that Tupac has passed. He looked as stunned as I felt. What do we do? Do we say it on the radio? I asked. Red Alert took a deep breath and said, yeah, Angie, you have to tell the people. And I knew I did. Nothing like this had happened before. I had no expertise in how to announce tragedy. I didn't know how it went. I wasn't a trained news reporter or a journalist with experience on how to cover breaking news stories or horrible crises, wars. I was still that kid who liked hip hop and somehow got a show on the radio. I don't know how you report on death. And I was so affected and emotional about it. Nobody had taught me the protocol for how to convey this kind of important news to our listeners. All I could do was trust my instincts and crack the mic. We spoke from the heart. Red Alert began. It's Hot 97. Red Alert and Angie, we have some bad news. Really sad bad news. And I continued. I just got word from University Medical Center of Southern Nevada that Tupac has passed away. Suddenly it sank in. I was overcome by emotion that caught in my voice and in my chest. I had never experienced anything so real on air. It was the realest it had ever gotten. And I just lost it. I just started crying. The mic was on. There was nothing I could do but just let it go. And all I could verbalize was, it just is what it is. God, I'm sad. I'm sure a lot of you are. At some point, we weren't even saying anything. The mic was just on for like a minute. And to this day, people tell me they had that moment with us, that they were there listening. It was the first time I had felt that type of vulnerability on the radio. It's not like it was something planned. It was just what was happening. It was just how it felt. It was just sad. It was awful. And then, of course, not that much longer after, MTV had gotten wind of it and reports started to show up on the news that Tupac was pronounced dead. The aftermath of that was so weird. Everything had changed. I think everyone in the culture started feeling crazy about how far everything had gotten, and this man's life was taken now. Over the past 4 months, I had known that Biggie had not been too pleased about me going to talk to Pac. All of that changed when Tupac died. A short time later, Biggie came up to the show to talk about how terrible it was that Pac had lost his life. No matter what they had been going through, he didn't wish that on anyone. We all felt the loss and understood the weight of the moment. No question. But we couldn't yet appreciate what Pac's legacy was going to be, or really how much what had just happened would change the whole trajectory of hip-hop, and how big of a part of hip-hop history this turning point would be. For my part, as grief set in, I was too emotional to think that far ahead. How could someone with so much talent and so much potential be gone? The news took longer to travel in those days, but as people started reacting with memorials and fans connected all over the world, I was amazed at how much larger than life Pac already was. For the longest time, I'd be walking through the street and so many strangers would approach me to say that they were listening when the news broke. They'd say, "We were crying with you on the radio. My whole family had the radio on." Over the years, I've often wondered if Pac had a kind of sixth sense that maybe his life was going to get cut short and so he had to just live more in less time. Clearly, his lyrics and images were full of death and dying. I do know, as complex as he was, he knew things. In fact, during my interview with him, there were two major lessons he taught me that have stuck with me ever since. The first came when I made the mistake of starting a question with, "Well, people say," and he stopped me. "Who are you talking about? What people? Because if you're just talking about niggas in the barbershop, you know they're going to talk shit no matter what you do. So don't talk to me about people and what people say." Maybe I knew that, but because I was young and nobody had ever put it like that in those terms, I listened. He was right. And in my career, I needed to know that. Yeah, there were always going to be people who want to talk shit because that's what they do. They sit in the barbershop or wherever and talk shit. And it helped cushion the blow later when there was talk that I needed to ignore. Pac telling me that was important at that time in my career. It saved me a lot of time that would have otherwise been wasted. His other lesson was along the same lines, but different. At one point, I had asked him if he regretted a career move that had turned out to be kind of stupid. He waved me off and he said he wasn't afraid of making a mistake. "My career ain't about that," Pac said. He told me that, yeah, he was gonna fuck up. But that was not ever going to be enough to erase everything else, all the years of good work. It may be obvious, but I hadn't heard it put that way. And I took it as gospel. So what if you make a mistake and fuck up? It can't erase or outweigh the other great things you've done if you've been at your career and working hard. A mistake or a setback doesn't have to define you. Both those lessons gave me courage that I carried from then on. He delivered those points as if he knew I'd value them. And he was right. The hip-hop world had barely stopped reeling from the loss of Pac when we faced another devastating blow. Biggie had been doing his best to keep positive and move forward after Pac passed. He took a trip to Los Angeles to promote his second album and to present at the Soul Train Music Awards. Lots of people thought it was too soon for him to go to L.A., but I think it was his way of showing love to the West Coast and letting everyone know that things would be okay. Aside from all the drama that had been going on with Pac, Biggie was busy making history of his own. He was already thought of by many as the greatest rapper alive, with just one album out. I remember when I first heard him rap on a cassette tape given to me by Salam. It was like nothing I had ever heard. That tape became legend before he even put out his debut album. In my opinion, nobody had ever put words together like B.I.G. That, combined with Puffy's marketing and branding genius, made Biggie's first album huge. Not just in New York, but everywhere. People were expecting greatness with the second album, and he was ready to deliver. After all that sadness, Biggie was our future. But on March 9th, 1997, early on a Sunday morning when I was asleep at my new apartment in Queens, I got a call that Biggie had been shot and killed. My God, no. I was shocked, overwhelmed, numb. And before any thoughts could register, I knew where I needed to be. I just popped up and ran to the station. It was supposed to be the calm after the storm. The sadness we'd felt as a culture after Pac died was supposed to be the worst of it. No one was prepared for more. I can't believe this happened. I can't believe this is still happening. At this point, it was just too much to process. I arrived at the station barely able to process how I would get on the radio and talk to my listeners about the death of our hometown hero. This was different. This is New York. And I would be talking to the people who knew Big best. Not just his fans, but his family, his neighbors, our peers in the music industry who knew him well. It was way more intimate. We had all gotten to know Biggie. He was a really likable guy. The type that would walk into a room and make everyone feel good. He made everybody laugh, quick and witty. We knew what block he was from. We partied together. We rooted for him. And as famous as he'd become, he was still very much ours. He was accessible. When I hosted events at local clubs, it wasn't uncommon for him to show up. I'd be surprised every time and ask what he was doing there. His answer was always the same. "I came to show love." As I'm getting my thoughts together, my boss asked me to talk to the local news channel, New York One. He wanted a representative from Hot 97 to explain the impact of Biggie's death on the hip-hop community. Most of what he said went right through me. I was in no condition or mindset to do anything so formal. But I didn't have the energy to argue. I went downstairs to be interviewed in front of the building, and when the camera rolled, I just lost it. I was so spent, and it was just so fucking sad. I spent the whole week on air letting people call in and talk about their big experiences. Plenty of artists called in and showed up at the station as well. Everyone was taking it really hard. I remember pulling up to the funeral home on the Upper East Side and seeing hundreds of people behind the barricades, many holding signs and many crying. Fans and followers reacted to his death like they had lost a member of their family. During the open casket service, I kept looking over at different faces. Junior Mafia, Little C's, and everybody else I had enjoyed so many happy, fun relationships with. All of that was in contrast to this terrible moment of sorrow. Real deep down sorrow. Biggie songs and lyrics kept coming to me that day. The thing about the Notorious B.I.G. was that you always knew it was him from the first word he spoke. Before he died, he had only released one album back in September 1994. And that was true of every song, from Big Papa to my favorite Unbelievable. It was painful to recall that that first album was titled Ready to Die. After the funeral service, there was going to be a big procession to accompany Biggie's hearse and drive through his neighborhood of Brooklyn. As we were all walking out, I saw Mary J. Blige, Little Kim, and a few others heading toward their car. One of them turned back to say, "Ange, come with us." So I followed them, not sure where we were going. As we were walking, Kim was crying, like crying from her gut. They both got in the car, but I waited outside. I didn't want to intrude on this moment. It was too real. And then I heard someone call, "Come in the car. Kim wants you to come in the car." I remember sitting in that car with Kim and a couple of her girlfriends, and Mary was sitting next to her. I didn't even know what to say or how to feel. I had just watched the movie Steel Magnolias and loved that scene when the daughter dies and at the funeral one of them says to the mom, "I don't know how you're feeling on the inside, but you look amazing on the outside." And really, looking at Kim, she did look beautiful. If I had to show up for a funeral for somebody that I loved, I would probably be in a scrunchie and something that didn't match. I mean, how do you pull yourself together at a time like that? I could tell she was in pain, but she still looked good. So I just said that. I said, "Kim, I don't know how you feel inside, but you look beautiful." And she stopped crying for a minute and looked at me, and she just laughed for a second like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Then Kim said, "That's the weirdest thing to say, but thank you." Everything else about that funeral was a blur. The next day, in all the coverage about the send-off for Biggie, the newspaper featured a picture of Kim walking with Mary. You could see Kim's pain in that picture. For all of us, I think in a way it was the end of innocence. We had learned hard lessons. Everyone was changed. Fittingly, when the album Biggie had just finished before he died came out posthumously, it was called Life After Death. It went on to sell more than 10 million copies, barely edging out Tupac's posthumous album of greatest hits, which sold a little under 10 million. And Pac's All Eyes on Me, which is up at around 9 million copies sold to date. In the wake of their deaths, there was a sobering process that took hold across the industry and in the community. The whole battle between the two coasts faded in the rearview mirror of where hip-hop was headed to next. To becoming really big business. You could just feel it as we got into the later 1990s. Hip-hop was not being so niche anymore. It was definitely the time of the bigger money, the big multi-million dollar production videos, and the crazy excesses that came along with going fast from nothing to everything. Biggie had warned everyone, "More money, more problems." It was an interesting time coming up, because I had found my voice and my lane in radio and would start to be given other opportunities. The next challenge for me would be to find a way of keeping my focus without getting caught up in all the craziness. The lessons I'd learned so far from Biggie and Pac would eventually help me stay grounded. But not right away. I'd have to make a few mistakes first. It may sound strange coming from someone like me who doesn't look back at the past much, but I think of the lessons of this period all the time. Something that has kept them fresh comes from a discovery that a friend of mine made about 3 years ago. In an exhibit of Tupac memorabilia, one of the items preserved was a handwritten letter on notebook paper that Tupac wrote to me all those years ago. It hangs on my kitchen wall today. to Angie Martinez, for being true when false behavior was fashionable, for never dirtying my name on the air, for being what is so hard to find, a real motherfucker. I owe you one. Collect whenever needed most. Signed, Tupac Shakur. There was irony in that I never received this letter, and that he never received mine. Part 2. Voice of New York, 1997 to 2001. Chapter 6. Almost Famous. As the clouds and the haze of that heavy period lifted, my relationship with my listeners was stronger than ever. Like any relationship, when you go through something together, it brings you closer. You begin to have shared memories, and you get to know each other on another level. I often talk about that with aspiring radio personalities because I think that's the key to longevity. In developing a real relationship with your audience, you're giving them a chance to get to know you and trust who you are. Knowing that helped me immensely because the answer to how to handle any challenge on air became, just be honest. Just be yourself. The summer of 1997 was a memorable time. Our summer jam concert that Hot 97 put on each year was shaping up to be bigger than ever. 20,000 people would show up to MetLife Stadium to see who was going to diss who was going to kill it, and who was going to get booed. Legendary things happened that summer jam that everyone wanted to be there to witness. It always set the picture of what was happening in hip-hop, almost like a recap of everything that had happened in the year so far. What I remember most from that year was a sense of wanting to come together to remember Biggie. As much as we were all trying to move forward, there wasn't an artist that hit that stage that didn't pay some sort of homage to B.I.G. Rest in peace shout-outs were the theme of the night. As one of the DJs who got to welcome the crowd, this was the time every year that I got to come face-to-face with so many members of our core audience in one place. It was always overwhelming to see people I talked to every day on the radio looking back at me. They came from so many different backgrounds, black, Latino, white, you name it. They were hardcore hip-hop heads. They'd come up and say they're teachers who listen and try to engage with their students in hip-hop. Others would say they'd just gotten out of jail and the highlight of their day was listening to me on my show. They'd tell me their favorite battle of the beats or why they love a certain interview. I really started to notice a difference in how people were responding to me. More and more people were showing up at the parties I was hosting and stopping me in the street to say hi. Ever since I'd been at Hot 97, taking part in the Puerto Rican Day Parade had become my favorite public event. I had been going since I was a little kid and never missed it. My grandma Petra used to take me, and we'd sit on the sidelines waving our flags with pride. My most vivid memory was of being 8 years old and seeing Eric Estrada pass by on a float. He played Ponch in the TV show Chips. The show was a big hit that year, and Estrada was the breakout star, and he was Puerto Rican. My grandma and I got so excited, you would have thought we'd just seen the Pope. I was jumping up and down, and all the girls around us were screaming. He looked right in our direction and smiled and waved. Man, I talked about it the whole way home. So I loved this parade. I felt connected to it. All of the years had been fun to be on the float with everybody from the station, and the crowd was always with me. But that summer of 1997 in particular, there was more attention than usual. People were starting to ask for pictures while we were setting up the float on one of the side streets. Of course, it was a big float that said Hot 97 all over it, and we were blasting hip-hop before the parade even started. So it wasn't weird that people would walk over and hang around and take pictures with all of us. What I did not see coming was that when it was our turn to hit the parade route, at the instant our float turned onto Fifth Avenue, I heard a monstrous roar. People's flags went up, and that roar of excitement came from the crowd and filled up my whole being. In the moment, you can't really explain to anyone what is happening to you, so you just go with it. You roar back. I waved my flag with all my might, and I did my best to make eye contact with as many people as I could. I saw groups of young girls that looked like they could be my sister screaming my name from behind the barricade. Angie, we love you, Angie. Oh my God, this had never happened before. I felt so humbled and grateful that so many people who came from where I did felt such a connection to my success. It was theirs too. I fought back tears for the next 35 blocks. People were showing me love on a regular basis. I know that may sound like no big deal to some, But I promise it's a strange and amazing thing when you're not prepared for it. You want to give it back to everyone. But as one person, it's challenging. And I've always felt almost guilty about it. I want to shout, I'm a regular person. I'm not a celebrity. Through the highs and lows, I was always okay with keeping fame at an arm's length. I've always been fascinated by celebrity and how it affects people. And how most of the time it makes people act nuts. One thing I had going for me is that I'd been around radio for a long time. So I didn't let any of it go to my head. My mother being in radio helped too, because she had prepared me for the fact that even the most popular of radio personalities can be replaced. So I never got too comfortable or gassed. I was still just grateful to be there. And it was my goal to stay there. So while my ego was intact, I wasn't completely in the clear. I did feel the pressure to step my game up. People around me were definitely cultivating the lifestyle that went along with that. Flex had jewelry and cars with big rims. I saw rappers who started with nothing rapidly become millionaires. The irony of becoming sort of famous was that I was still not really making shit from the radio station. On the other hand, I was getting a paper bag full of cash every night from being in the clubs. So why wouldn't I think I should buy a BMW? Why wouldn't I think I should move into a luxury high-rise building? Why wouldn't I want to live that life? G and I had broken up and I felt like I needed a new start anyway. As Nikki liked to point out over the years, every time I had a breakup, my next step was to pick up and move. She's right, and I did. I found the brand new high-end building in Forest Hills, Queens, called The Pinnacle, with a valet, doormen, beautiful views, and a wraparound terrace. It was crazy. I took the first apartment I could find in the building and paid my deposit in cash. I was living the life. Fancy restaurants, new clothes, partying in VIP. The only problem was that I had no idea how to balance a checkbook. And it wasn't even something I cared too much about. My phone service would get shut off and I'd just call and get it back on. My lights would get turned off and I'd call the electric company, pay the money, and then have them turned back on. I would run out of gas in my car on the road all the time. I had no order in my life and I had never had money before, so once I got it, I spent it. And when late notices arrived, who had time for that? I was out of control, and then shit got crazy. I came home late one night from hosting a party in the Bronx. I had been out of the house all day and I was exhausted, so I could not wait to get home. I valeted my car, and as I walked in the building, Hector, the doorman, an avid Hot 97 listener, as most of the guys in the building were, said, "Yo, Ange. Hey, what's up, Hector?" "I think they locked you out of your crib," he said. "Huh? What are you talking about?" "Yeah, the landlord came with the sheriff and put something on your door so you can't get in." As fast as I could move, I flew into the elevator, rode it upstairs, and ran to my front door. Sure enough, as I stood there staring in shame, there was a padlock on the door and an oversized notice barring my entrance. I had been evicted. I was so embarrassed. Everything I owned was inside that apartment. Standing there just looking at the notice, I was certain that everybody in the building probably knew by now. Mortified, I rode the elevator back down and had to walk past the doorman again. This time with my head down. I could feel Hector judging me. I drove to Brooklyn that night to sleep at Nikki's new place on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn. And then a few days later, I found myself walking into the courthouse and entering that damn eviction office. I kept thinking about how half the people sitting in there were probably my listeners. Again, I'm feeling the judgment. Hiding behind sunglasses, I felt that awkwardness of my public persona glaring back at me. My God, how did I let this happen? It took a couple of weeks, but eventually I paid all the fines, got my paperwork together, and got back into my place. And I vowed that this would never happen to me again. While I was zooming through the whirlwind working nights, Flex and I saw each other less. He seemed to have backed up for me a little bit. And our friendship felt strained. I didn't really know why at first, but my label rep friends would tell me, "Yo, Flex says that if I bring my artists to your show first, he wouldn't support them." It was so weird being in that place with him. I loved Flex, and I respected him. But somehow we had become in competition with each other, and I didn't even know it. Maybe I should have. It very well could have been my fault. I was so consumed with my own ambition. In hindsight, that could have been an issue. But why wouldn't I be? Why wouldn't I try to book the hottest parties, the best guests, or get exclusives for Battle of the Beats? You see, in my mind, Flex was always just so far ahead of me that it never occurred to me I may have been stepping on his toes. And our relationship wasn't developed to the extent where he trusted me enough to know that my heart was good. I wasn't trying to be an asshole. I just didn't know any better. I confronted him about it a few times, but he just kind of brushed it off. It was a weird time in Hot 97. Ed Lover and Dr. Dre had been doing mornings now for a couple of years, and the station was focused on branding them. Wendy Williams was on in the afternoon. Wendy had come in after Hot 97 bought adult R&B station Kiss FM in December 1994. And there was almost an air of resentment from her toward the station and all of us. So I was cordial, but I kept my distance. And then Flex was on after me. I mean, we were all popping in our own right. Ratings were like nothing anyone had ever seen, and there was really no outside competition. But because of that, I think we just started to compete with each other, which may have given me an incentive to say yes to opportunities I might not have otherwise. I'm thinking of the night when I happened to be hosting a party at a club in Long Island and KRS-One was performing. Before he went on stage, I was on the mic, and afterwards KRS says, "You know, you're really good on the mic. You got a good presence. Your voice is strong. Have you ever rhymed before?" I laughed and said, "You know, just for fun, whatever, here and there. But no, I'm not a rapper." "You should come to the studio one night," KRS says. "You'd probably sound really good on a record." What? Me? This is KRS-One, arguably one of the best MCs to ever grab a mic. Is he out of his mind? He must be. But there was no way in hell I would miss an opportunity to be in a studio and play rapper with one of the greats. So of course I went. KRS told me he had a session with Showbiz at Chung King Studios in Midtown and that I should meet him there around 10 o'clock. I showed up a little early at 9:45, nervous and questioning my decision. No sooner had I entered the lobby than I hear the big, iconic KRS voice. "Angie, you made it. Welcome, welcome. Come in," he said as he walked toward me and then stopped. "You by yourself?" He was surprised. "Yeah, I'm alone. If I was going to play myself, I preferred to do it in front of the smallest amount of people possible." But I didn't say that. Instead, I followed him into a dark room. It was loud. It smelled like weed and incense, and the beat playing was a sample of Treacherous Three's Feel the Heartbeat. It was all dope, and everything I had always imagined the KRS session should look like. And then I spotted Redman. Redman's Muddy Waters album had just been certified gold, and there he was sitting in the corner smoking a blunt without a care in the world. "Ange, what up?" he said from his position on the black leather couch, notebook in hand. "This is too much. KRS-One and Redman's here? Why am I here? This is fucking nuts." KRS said, "You don't have to do anything. I'm going to write a verse for you." Redman just laughed. I don't think he knew why I was there either. "Okay, but you sure? I've never done anything like this. I mean, I'll try it if it sounds terrible." "Just try it," KRS encouraged. "Who cares? If it sounds good, I'm going to keep it. I'm not going to keep it if it's whack." So he wrote it down. I mean, he definitely wrote the verse. I went in the booth and I tried it. "It's the butter peeking, reeking, speaking, deleting, other radio jocks that think they competing." When I came out of the booth, Redman was sitting there, still smoking a blunt. And he said to me, matter-of-factly, "Yo, you sound all right. I can't even front. You sound all right on that." I don't know. That shit sounds weird to me. But KRS loved it. They wound up keeping it and putting the song out and calling it Heartbeat. And for the most part, people liked it. Sure, some people felt weird about it, like, what is she doing? What are you doing with her on there? She's not a rapper. I wasn't, but this was KRS-One and Redman. What was I supposed to do? Say no? No way. Then came the video. KRS told me to come up to the video shoot on the roof of a theater by the radio station. This is how green I was. There was no stylist. There was no hair. There was no makeup. I'm in a squishy nylon sweatsuit and some sneakers like, okay, I'm here for the video. That was it. And they just threw me in. I'd never done a video before. And then all of a sudden, I'm just doing a video. I was so in awe of being there with them. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing there. Actually, the video never came out, but they wound up using a clip of it in KRS-One's A Friend video. The clip was cute, and we really did have fun shooting it. KRS, Redman, and me bopping in unison on a rooftop. It was a B-girl's dream come true. For a brief stint, I thought that was the end of my ride as an artist and didn't think twice about it. But out of the blue, one day I got a call from Lance Unrivera. He was Biggie's former business partner, and Lil' Kim was signed to his label, Undias, at the time. "I'm putting a bunch of girls on this song, Ladies Night. You sounded really good on that Heartbeat joint," Un said, explaining that Kim was doing a Not Tonight remix with Left Eye, The Brat, and Missy Elliott. And they wanted me on the song. My new Ladies Night show on Friday nights with DJ Jazzy Joyce and DJ Coco Chanel was taking off, so he thought it was a good fit. "You should jump on this. Do the intro." It's so funny how once you rap on something, people just assume now you're a rapper. And I'm expected to write a rhyme. I had never written a rap. That last time, KRS-One wrote it for me. Now I'm expected to write a rap that would have to stand next to the biggest female rappers in the game. So I called Salam, DJ Doo-Wop, and a few people for advice. And Doo-Wop, God bless him, gave me some pointers. "Maybe change the word to this and try this." I must have spent 2 days in my house with a pad and a pen writing pages worth of shit that was probably all terrible. I wrote about 100 bars because I didn't know what was good and what was whack. Finally, at the appointed hour, I went into the studio session at the Hit Factory and Un was waiting. "Do you have something? You got a verse?" "I don't know if I got a verse, but I got about 2 pages of rhymes," I told him. I actually didn't even know how to count bars or what the standard structure of a verse was. Un gave me a look like, "It's not that serious," and said, "Get your ass in the booth." So I went in the booth and I just started doing all of it, everything that I had written. We did it a bunch of times and Un picked the best 8 bars. "It's Ladies Night, what? It must be Angie on the mic. The butter pea, honey, got the sugar, got the spice. Roll the L's tight. Keep the rhymes right. Y'all just made this motherfucker up last night. And I'm the rookie on this all-star team. Me and Kim's getting cream, like Thelma and Louise." "This is the part," he confirmed. And then added, "I may have you come back in once I get all the other girls in place to do some ad-libs." "Okay, cool, whatever you need," I said. "If you don't like it, you don't have to use it. It's okay, I understand." No, it's good. It's really good." This was all so outside of my realm of experience that I couldn't tell if it was really good or he was just saying so. In any event, not too much later, I was called back to the studio to do some ad-libs. Left Eye was there when I arrived. TLC was one of my favorite girl groups of all time, and Left Eye was iconic. She had recently been all over the news for burning her man's house down. It was the biggest story at the time, being circulated all over the world. And there I was in the studio while she wrote, "I'll be the one to blame as the flames keep rising to the top and it don't stop." With all her success and everything she had been going through, Left Eye could have been standoffish, but she wasn't. She was sweet and giving. One of the first things she said was, "I really like your verse." "You do?" I was so worried. "Yeah, sounds really good." When I went in the booth, Left Eye did everything she could to make me feel comfortable and confident, like I belonged there. 5 years later, when she died too young, I remembered how helpful and encouraging she had been to me that day. Thinking back, all of the women on that song were like a team. And everyone, Left Eye, Lil' Kim, The Brat, Missy Elliott, and me, had good vibes towards each other. The next thing I knew, we were flying off to West Palm Beach to shoot the video. This was back in the day when the big budget music videos were everything. They had us scuba diving and riding jet skis and so many other top female artists like Mary J. Blige, Queen Latifah, and SWV came out to do cameos and support the video. It was like living out a fantasy that I would have been embarrassed to even admit I'd ever had. But still, I wasn't getting ready to quit my day job. At the same time, I was just riding the wave as the song's success build. People were coming up and quoting, "It must be Angie on the mic," and telling me how they just loved the video. It wasn't just a New York thing. In fact, after the single was released in July of 1997, Not Tonight, Ladies Night Remix took off and stayed in the Hot 100 for 21 weeks, peaking at number 6. When Grammy nominations were announced, it would be nominated for Best Rap Song by a duo or group, though it would later lose to Puffy and Fate's I'll Be Missing You, a tribute to Biggie. Getting the nomination was a huge deal. Even before that, just as nuts, we were asked to perform at the MTV Video Awards in September of 97. Perform? As in perform live and in person on TV? I don't know how to fucking perform. At Radio City Music Hall on the night of the awards, June Ambrose styled us. But June had her hands full. Along with Kim and Missy and everybody else, she was also styling Puffy, who was performing I'll Be Missing You. Clearly, I was at the bottom of June's priority list. So she gave no fucks about me. Like, literally, we were about to go on stage and I still had no shoes. Not trying to be a diva or anything, I nicely said, I don't have any shoes. Do you have anything? And one of June's assistants came running up with this terrible pair of clunky black shoes. I didn't have management. I didn't have a stylist. I just showed up with a ponytail like, okay, we're going to perform at the MTV Awards. It was a nightmare. More than anything, it was embarrassing to be unprepared. Not that I saw being an artist as part of my destiny. At the time, I chalked it up as a blip. A really cool one, but just a moment. While that's how I was looking at it, record labels saw it differently. Not too long after the MTV Awards, I started to get calls. And not just calls, but interest from multiple labels for me to do my own album. This ride just kept getting crazier. A whole album? Salam was the one who convinced me to at least take the meetings. If you still want to say no, at least you'll know what you're turning down. He was right. Why the hell not hear what they had to say? My attitude was, here I go again into uncharted territory. I tried to do what had worked for me in the past by staying open and looking to learn all that I could. That attitude freed me, and it helped me up my game in other areas too. Chapter 7, Ready or Not. At 26 years old, in the fall of 1997, I started to understand the importance of keeping my inner circle tight. For the most part, I'd always been a good judge of character. And my friends not only protected me as my popularity grew, but they kept me grounded. That became meaningful to me the more I found myself surrounded by people in the business. Record promoters, club promoters, DJs, and aspiring artists. Not that they were bad people, it's just that when you let too many others into your life, especially people with agendas, it leaves room for error and messiness. See, the thing about success is that people want to stand next to it. They want a piece of it. They want access to it. People begin to see you as an opportunity. And if you're not careful, you could wake up one day and realize that all of your friends are not really your friends. I've seen it happen to too many people and always refused to let it happen to me. My defining line became, I don't want to be around people who don't want the best for me. And I don't want to be with somebody who resents my drive. For all those reasons, I actively cherish friends closest to me like Nikki and my girlfriends Tracy and Liani. Of course, I'd known Nikki for most of my life, and at this point, we were more like sisters than friends. Nikki, still tall and model thin, always more conservative than me, was moving up professionally in her career in the financial district. We still didn't have the same interests, but she had my back, and I always trusted her judgment. There were times when I'd bring a new friend around, and Nikki would simply say, I don't know about her. And that was enough for me, because she was always right. When Nikki and I met Tracy and Liani, we all clicked right away. Tracy, also Puerto Rican and from Washington Heights, loved hip-hop as much as I did. She knew all the lyrics and would come to the clubs in sneakers because they were easier to dance in. She was my type of girl. As Tracy started to make her way up the business ladder in sales and marketing, she could be more conservative in attire, but her heart was always hip-hop. Now Liani, who was to Tracy what Nikki was to me, best friends for many years, was much more conservative. Liani's family was from Spain, and she was more girly, almost prissy, always put together perfectly. She and Nikki always had great manners, while Tracy and I never really gave a fuck. Liani, who would go into PR and eventually become an executive, was very into fashion, style, and pop culture. Between the four of us, there was never a lack of fun or fun stuff to talk about. And most importantly, we trusted each other. On the romantic side of things, in this period, I had started seeing Q-Tip again. And this time, it was more of a real relationship. He was still that guy who the first time we met made me feel like we'd known each other forever. Tip was someone I trusted as a friend, who made me comfortable, who gave me encouragement and acted as a sounding board for me. as the competitive atmosphere at the station began to intensify, especially in the wake of the MTV Awards and the possibilities of getting an album deal. Tip was the first person to come to my defense if someone said something bad about me. Tip would invariably say, "They're fucking crazy." He had my back no matter what. Even sometimes when I might not have been in the right, he would defend me and take my side. You have to love that. Between Tip and the advice I had gotten from Pac not to worry so much about what is said by people who are going to talk shit anyway, I tried to keep a thick-skinned attitude. And that's what I did at first, as far as some comments I started to hear about Wendy Williams having a problem with me. But why? If I thought back to when she first arrived at the station, I couldn't remember any reason for it. During this time when I was doing nights, Wendy Williams was on afternoons. So obviously I'd come on after her and the two of us would see each other in passing at the station. Wendy was a really big personality in her own right. Tall and intense. Everything about her was a lot. A lot of hair, a lot of makeup, a lot of presence. She'd walk down the hall like she owned it. She'd done radio for way longer than me, and I always liked her on the air. She was offensive and outrageous, but extremely entertaining. As much as I enjoyed her, I was smart enough to keep my distance. Wendy would go about her business and I would go about mine. She would talk shit about the artist all day and then they would come to my show at night to tell their side of whatever the story was. It was like an unintentional game of good cop, bad cop. And for the station, it was a win-win. But as much as she was killing the ratings and people were tuned in, I'm sure getting booed at events wasn't fun for her. And I'm sure the fact that I was booking all the guests was irritating too. Flex pulled me aside one day to say that Dougie Fresh's promo calling me the hottest chick on the radio was Dougie's way of shitting on Wendy. Huh? It was? I never looked at it that way because for a few years now I had been the only chick there. That type of personalized drop was the norm. But I did take notice and I tried to be a little more sensitive. Not that it would matter to Wendy. People would repeat an unflattering comment Wendy had made in general and they'd add, "She's probably talking about you." My reply was consistent. "Whatever, that's just Wendy. She talks shit about everybody." But then it started to come more directly, with others telling me, "Yo, she don't like you, clearly." The sensible thing to do, I figured, was to talk to her. Keep things cool and clear the air. I hate weirdness with people. I planned to approach her at work after her show ended before mine got started. So when I arrived, as Wendy was going off the air, the first person I saw was my producer, Patty Duke, who was getting my show ready. He was a small guy with a big Italian personality who was a fiercely loyal member of the Hot 97 team. Then I saw Wendy about to leave. "Patty, would you mind stepping outside for a minute?" I asked, and waited a half a beat as he left. Then I turned to Wendy. She could see I had something to say, so she just stood there like, "Well, Wendy, people keep telling me that you're taking jabs at me," I began. She stared back as if to say, "What are you talking about?" "I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying that's what the perception is," I went on. "I've been ignoring it, but I just wanted to make sure that we're good." "Well, you know, I'm just doing my job. I didn't really say anything, but okay, whatever, no problem." She was defensive and barely looked me in the eye and was clearly uncomfortable, so I let it go. Then she did it again. I kept bringing it up to her, but being nice about it. In essence, I'd say, "Look, I don't want us to have any problems. I know you're not saying my name, but you're saying shit that feels funny." I gave her examples, like her comment that, you know, these other radio personalities are out here hanging out with the artist. Wendy came from the school of, "You can't be friends with the artist because then you can't talk shit about them." And I understood. That was her thing and she was great at it. But I never felt that way. To me, I respected the artist. I respected the culture and I always wanted them to feel comfortable in my house. That's just who I was. I wasn't necessarily out here looking for friends, but I always wanted to treat people with respect.